Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
It's Here and Now. Midnight tonight is the deadline for a new contract for Northwest Airlines and its mechanics union. The two sides are still in negotiation today. However, late yesterday, union leaders thought that a settlement was unlikely. Joining me on the line from Ann Arbor, Michigan, is Micheline Maynard, a business reporter for the New York Times. Welcome, Mickey.
Thanks very much.
What are the issues here?
Well, the issues basically come down to jobs. Northwest Airlines is proposing cuts of $176 million to the mechanics. The mechanics have countered with cuts of $100 million. But what's at issue here really is that Northwest thinks it needs only about half the number of mechanics that it's using now. What's happening in the airline industry is that a lot of this maintenance work is being subcontracted, and Northwest simply doesn't want to employ the people that it can get cheaper.
Would Northwest welcome a strike?
Northwest is ready for a strike. Northwest has an extensive plan to use replacement mechanics, and they've actually gone out and hired temporary workers who were licensed mechanics at other airlines. They also anticipate that the flight attendants could walk out in sympathy for the mechanics, and they've hired replacement flight attendants as well. These people have just been on retainer, as you were, for about 3 months waiting for something to happen.
And it appears that Wall Street also anticipates and would favor a strike, given what happened yesterday and earlier today.
Wall Street is absolutely rooting for a strike because Northwest is the last of the big airlines to tackle its labor cost issues. And they think it's just time for Northwest to get at it, and if it takes a strike, that's fine.
Are the other airlines watching closely, or have they already taken the steps, as you suggest, that Northwest is apparently about to take?
Well, the other airlines, the other big airlines, have pretty much gone through this themselves. Northwest is almost the last one to do this. What actually are watching are members of unions at other airlines, because they're seeing a union that's at least threatening to stand up to an airline, which is something that the other unions threatened to do and then caved in at the last minute. So it may take this mechanics union to make the stand that the other unions didn't make.
Of course, seen the other way, if Northwest is successful in hiring laid-off union workers from other airlines, that could also send a message to those unions, I guess.
What's interesting about the Northwest situation is that the current union, which is called the Aircraft Mechanics Fraternal Association, actually organized the mechanics away from the traditional mechanics union, the International Association of Machinists. And so the machinists union is watching this and saying, well, maybe if they bust AMFA, we could go back in and organize these workers again.
And given the fact that Northwest is ready to replace the flight attendants as well, how likely is it that the flight attendants will walk out in sympathy?
Well, the flight attendants know that if they walk out in sympathy, it's very likely they'll lose their jobs. And there's even a question about some of the mechanics, too, a question of whether the strike would hold, because these people also know that if they walk out, that they'll lose their jobs. And right now, jobs in the airline industry are shrinking. They're not expanding unless you're working at one of the low-fare airlines, and Northwest Airlines is clearly not a low-fare airline.
Right, and Northwest hasn't said whether it would hire back any of the striking workers once there was a settlement.
Well, it's generally, once you settle, if you do settle with this union, then you take everybody back. The bigger question is whether Northwest would feel any compulsion to settle with AMFA. Now, they've said they'd like to reach a consensual agreement. They'd like to do this without a strike. And I truly believe that that is the intention, that a strike is the last resort here. But things are so dire in the airline industry that, you know, last resort is truly last resort.
Well, as you said, Northwest has been prepared for this strike. They're also preparing for bankruptcy. How does this strike and the contract negotiations play into those plans?
Northwest Airlines does have a cost issue. What they're trying to do is settle new contracts with other unions and get $1.1 billion in concessions. They really need that money. They are the last of the airlines, as I said, to get the cost cuts. They have been posting losses consistently. And another thing that could be driving a possible bankruptcy is the change in bankruptcy laws that takes place on October 17th. So if you haven't filed by then, you lose some of your flexibility. A strike at Northwest Airlines could be maybe the excuse to file for bankruptcy if it disrupts their operations. Conversely, if they're able to operate with a strike, what that'll show is that maybe this company is a little more resilient than everybody thought.
So do you think the strike is likely?
I'm 60-40. I've watched a lot of unions go right to the brink in the airline industry and then pull back as they look over the edge. So I guess I'm still holding out a little bit of doubt that there will be a strike, but if there is one, I wouldn't be surprised at that either.
Mickey, thank you.
My pleasure.
Micheline Maynard is a business reporter for the New York Times. Her most recent book, The End of Detroit, How the Big Three Lost Their Grip on the American Car Market, is now out in paperback. This summer, many MBA students are passing up jobs on Wall Street for a chance to work in Bangalore, India, a city some call the outsourcing capital of the world. I'm joined in the studio by two future captains of American industry, J.J. Marshall, an MBA student from the Babson College Graduate School of Business, and by Jeff Anders, a student at MIT's Sloan School of Management. Both spent their summer working in Bangalore, where they witnessed the explosive growth of India's economy firsthand and had a chance to think about what that growth might mean for American companies, consumers, and workers. They recently returned to Boston and have recovered enough in their jet lag to talk with us. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
So, Jeff, let me start with you. What were you doing and what did you see?
I was working over at Hewlett-Packard, helping them take outsourcing to the next level. Outsourcing is traditionally associated with call centers and data entry. We were hiring a team of Indian-educated, Indian-born PhDs in stats and economics and setting up a team to perform analysis and predictive modeling for Western multinational companies.
So outsourcing really has moved up the scale now. We're not talking about sort of low-level consumer complaint calls anymore.
Absolutely. You have outsourcing now of medical analysis, engineering design, high-end research and development. Mm-hmm.
And all educated, as you say, the folks who are working there got their PhDs in India.
Correct. Yeah. And now the management, which was originally coming over from the West, expat, has now been replaced with even local management.
JJ, what were you doing?
I was working at a company called Arvind Brands, which manages 9 different clothing brands that are largely manufactured in India and distributed and sold exclusively within India. So it's a little bit different from what we're talking about, but it still has to do with the fact that India as a country is experiencing incredible growth in the retail sector.
Well, Jeff, why did you decide to go there rather than Wall Street?
I wanted to go where it was happening. Before school, I was working in management consulting. I helped a major U.S. airline outsource work to Mexico and overseas. Once I got to school, I saw, wow, this is really happening, and it's happening in a big way. So I wanted to go over and see it for myself.
JJ, how about you?
That's precisely my reason as well. I just, you know, I've been reading enough about what's happening, and you just kind of want to go see it for yourself.
Was it everything you expected?
I didn't expect to see quite the study in extremes, that chasm between migrant laborers, say, and people working in this, you know, in this extremely fast-paced sector of this developing economy. I didn't expect to see quite the disparity.
How about you, Jeff?
I want to echo that. An image that really resonated with me was sort of the contrast. I did expect to see office towers and golf courses. I did not expect to see that running right between those two would be a river of untreated raw sewage.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that surprised me was, you know, I knew the people were educated. I knew they were doing good work. I knew they were doing it faster, better, and cheaper than we could. I didn't realize that when they wake up every morning, they're not asking themselves whose job they're stealing. They're asking themselves, how can I improve my lot? How can I do better for my family?
Well, I wonder, did you get a sense, and I know that you were just there this summer, so it's hard to get a perspective, but any sense that that vision is a new vision and new even and almost a surprising vision for Indians? Do they find themselves saying, wait, I don't have a right to dream this way?
There's a phrase that's used to kind of describe this generation of people. They're post-liberalization children.
We call them the BPO crowd.
Yeah.
BPO?
Business process outsourcing. Uh-huh. People with laptops sitting in coffee shops like Starbucks and listening to iPods.
And it's funny, once these changes have been made and they grew up with them as just that was their status quo as teenagers. So as they were getting their advanced degrees, I don't think it ever occurred to them that they were perhaps in a position that they should be especially grateful for. I mean, they do have their parents, most of whom they still live with, actually. The fabric of the Indian family is much more tightly knit than ours is. It's a much less individualistic society than the one we live in, but there's no sense of what I'm getting is from your question, no sense of extreme gratitude. This belongs to us.
Yeah, but it does suggest that there might be a kind of cultural shock between generations. Do you sense any of that?
Absolutely. This is the first generation now that is sort of coming into its own. It's the first generation with the internet, with real insight into what's happening across the world. They're earning more than their parents ever did, and now they're kind of supporting their parents as well. So I've asked people, you know, you guys see all this opportunity and all this change happening. Would you be, you know, can you envision yourself going out on your own, becoming an entrepreneur? And the pressure from the family to be risk-averse and save and support is tremendous.
Because they're the sole support of their families. You're suggesting that the family, because it's closer, because there's less a sense of individuality, they feel like, I can't go and invest in some crazy venture. I got my mom to support.
Individualism is, I think, a new concept in India right now.
Well, is it catching on at all? I mean, do you see any signs at all that some folks are breaking loose of that sort of family communal tradition and moving into the American way of doing things?
I think so. There was a tremendous you mentioned them being risk averse. I think that, for example, the equity markets were not popular for individual investors. They're becoming so now. The notion of consumer credit, totally alien prior to the liberalization reforms, but now it's becoming commonplace. The idea of financing your home that way. I mean, it's all changing.
So credit cards and that sort of thing? Yeah.
Yeah, to add to that, I mean, sitting at my desk, I would receive minimum 3 calls a week from any one of the major banks, country clubs, credit cards. I mean, relentless telemarketing of all these things.
If you have a mobile phone in India, half the calls you take are from salespeople.
How do the go ahead, Jeff.
I was just going to add that to the consumer credit comment, whereas consumer credit is picking up now, the irony is that they use their credit cards but pay the balance at the end of every month.
So they don't carry a balance and have to pay interest on that.
So the culture is changing very slowly.
Do you see attitudes changing among East Indians with regard to foreigners being there at all? I mean, when guys like you show up, are they happy to see you? Are you well received? What's going on there?
They're reading their own press as far as the strength of the outsourcing movement right now. And there is a sense that they want to sort of feel you out to see whether or not you are someone who a job would rightfully move away from.
Jeff?
There was an article in The Economist about a study performed where people in different countries were asked which country they would like to move to for a better life. And India was the only country in that survey that said the U.S. So I found actually a pretty positive impression that people think of the United States as the promised land.
I'm talking with Jeff Anders from MIT's Sloan School of Business and J.J. Marshall from the Babson College Graduate School of Business, both just back from spending a summer working in Bangalore, India. We're talking about their reflections on outsourcing, the change in economy, globalization. We're going to take a break right now, and when we come back, talk about lessons learned and what the U.S. might learn from what's going on in India. Stay with us. Here and now, we're talking with Jeff Anders and J.J. Marshall, two MBA students who spent their summer working in Bangalore, India. They've recently returned, and they're speaking with us about what the growth of the Indian economy might mean for American companies and workers. And J.J., you were talking about the company you worked for, which is a subsidiary or works in collaboration with Lee Jeans. Tell us a little bit, first of all, about that relationship. It really is a wholly owned Indian company, is it not?
Yes, Arvind Brands, the name of the company, and it's a wholly owned subsidiary of Arvind Mills, which is one of the world's largest denim suppliers. But they've sort of taken this company on as a diversification strategy in the sense that these brands are sold, they're distributed, they're sold in India exclusively. And so it's sort of a hedge against what, you know, there's apparently a glut in the denim market. So they're at least able to.
I see they're going high end to carve a little niche. And they're doing very well.
They're doing extremely well. They're posting annual returns in the neighborhood of 30%.
Wow.
Lee Jeans, for example, in the last, I think about anywhere, maybe 3-year period is a compound annual growth rate of 23%.
Wow. And American companies really can't boast that kind of growth, can they?
Certainly not in the retail garment sort of sectors, not at all.
Is it just a matter of less expensive labor?
Less expensive labor is part of it, but I think the biggest part of it is you have a tremendous amount of disposable income that has been generated by this burgeoning middle class, and a lot of these folks live at home and have very limited expenses. So a lot of the money they earn goes straight into the retail market.
Jeff, is that growth widespread, or is that just what's going on at the Lee Jean subsidiary?
I think it's pretty widespread. I had a conversation with a guy who runs LG flat-screen TVs for South India or something, and he said that originally they were selling all of their screens to corporations. Now, in the last 8 months, they've seen explosive growth in the consumer market. And I think that every sector of the every part of the retail sector is seeing this growth now.
So globalization, American companies go to India to get cheap labor and get their products done according to the American business model. Now Indians are developing their own MBA programs and sending their own folks to work. Is their business model different than the U.S. model, and is there anything to learn from that?
The value proposition of these companies who are going out to American companies and saying, hey, let us do this work for you, is we will do the work for you better, faster, and cheaper. So it's not only cheaper, it's we'll do it for you at a higher quality and faster as well.
So the question then for Americans is, can American businesses compete ultimately as India builds up its own indigenous economy?
I read an article in Wired magazine that said that the one sort of competitive advantage that we have left is capacity for creativity, left brain thinking. There's a lot of R&D that we outsource, which was a real shock to me when I actually read that there's actual sort of product design, technology design that we outsource. But ultimately, the top tier of R&D is still kept here, and the product design and the marketing is still done largely here.
JJ's right. Unfortunately, that is slowly changing. And whereas, you know, 5 years ago, 95% of the value of any product from beginning to end was retained by the multinational companies or exported, repatriated to the United States, that number is eroding relatively quickly. And a lot of the R&D that was being done by foreign companies sort of in a shared services environment, so GE setting up its own R&D center in India, those people have now left and have set up their own indigenous Indian R&D companies, mm-hmm. and are developing their own products. That advantage will not be ours for long.
So that does suggest that the U.S. really is in for a fight.
Well, that said, we can compete. I mean, they're only as good as we are once they get up to the point where we're at.
Well, but I guess that assumes that they're going to follow the same path. But once you start thinking on your own and developing your own schools, you can do what Apple did to computers and say, we don't have to take a typewriter and digitize it. We can come up with a whole new system.
I think that's correct. I mean, that's ultimately where it's headed. There is an element of this conversation, though, that I think we're leaving out. And there's an AIDS crisis that is about to reach the tipping point there that the government is extremely reluctant to say anything about. And if it reaches crisis levels, this sort of untrammeled economic growth will definitely be mitigated by real social concerns. And, you know, we're talking about a very select part of the population. I think the country is still 55-60% rural. And within that sector, and also in the city environments, there's I think over half the population lives below the poverty line.
There are 400 million people living on less than a dollar a day in India. Mm. These cities were planned to grow at, 5% per year, if that, and all of a sudden this explosive growth happened. No one foresaw it. So infrastructure projects have now just begun to get started, but because of the democratic political system in India, when a government changes, it changes the philosophy of infrastructure building, and there are very visible infrastructure projects in Bangalore that have slowly started and then stopped.
And they languish. Yeah, there are these flyovers that are supposed to, these ramps that go up over busy intersections, and I gather some of them have been in the same sort of state of where they are in their construction process now sort of indefinitely.
These bridges to nowhere.
Yeah,
in the middle of things. So what do you say to politicians and workers in this country who are still upset, still angry that they've lost their jobs to people in Bangalore?
Well, there will be tough times ahead, I think. But the people over in India look at it and say, hey, you know, you guys have had a virtual monopoly on prosperity for the last 500 years. We want in.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely correct.
Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Frank.
Jeff Anders is a student at MIT's Sloan School of Management. J.J. Marshall attends Babson College's Graduate School of Business. Both are just back from spending the summer working in Bangalore, India. Next week on Here and Now, Monday is the new deadline for reaching agreement on a draft constitution in Iraq. We'll have an update, and we'll hear how one of the many candidates for president in Liberia plans to rebuild that country and bring Liberians in the U.S. back home. That's next week. Stay with us. There's more ahead Here and Now. Now, as the summer winds to a close, high school students around the country are beginning their annual rituals, shopping, gossiping about who broke up over the summer, preparing their first day of school outfits, and according to some parents and educators, stressing out. The latter, many say, is because of the high and sometimes unreasonable demands placed on young teenagers. They take advanced placement classes, participate in shows and clubs and play sports and organize charity benefits and yearn to attend the country's top colleges, all to get that big job. That intense pressure has caused some parents and many educators to engage in what some see as a losing battle, to take some of the stress out of high school. Among those parents is Donna Testa, whose two sons, Zeke, a sophomore, and Corey, a senior, attend Wellesley High School in Wellesley, Massachusetts. Welcome, Donna.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Tell us about Corey, though. Is he stressed?
Is Corey stressed? Corey would answer that in terms of academics. No, he doesn't feel a lot of stress and pressure.
Do you think he is under too much pressure?
No, I think Corey is not academically under too much pressure, and I think one of the main reasons is because we're letting him steer his own boat, guide his own way.
But you're on a committee that was formed to reduce stress at Wellesley. What kinds of things do you think are going on there that require this kind of committee?
First of all, a heightened awareness by the school administration and faculty that children are feeling more stress, higher incidences of hospitalizations, of eating disorders, of not just Wellesley, but everywhere, of suicide increased, really frightening, alarming incidences of things that are happening that are just making teachers and administration aware of the fact that kids are more stressed out.
Is that a result of school policies or is something else going on?
We don't know. We're just trying to explore what it could be. It's everything. It's life. We're not trying to alleviate all stress in everybody's life. That's ridiculous. We know that. We're trying to just bring an awareness to the fact that is there a good balance going on right now? One of the many things that comes up in conversations is the pressure of getting into a, quote, good, unquote, college.
Right.
And we're trying to dispel that perception.
What are some of the other things you're doing?
Some of the things we came up with for this year specifically, just to try, would be the elimination of midterm exams, not tests, not projects, just the midterm exams, an inclusion of some intramural sports for those kids that get cut from varsity and JV teams, and to attempt no homework to be given over vacation.
I don't think you'd get any educators who would disagree that kids are under enormous stress. Certainly the statistics and some of the problems you've cited are on the rise, and they're aware of those. But some argue that by lowering standards, by reducing the amount of homework, by eliminating tests, that is really going to start affecting the learning, and that's a place where pressure needs to be, if that's what it is, needs to be maintained.
Well, I really don't know. I don't know what the answer is to solve a problem of this magnitude. From a parental standpoint, parents put more pressure on their kids than I think we ever used to see or have done to them. And as a parent, I'm just taking that stance that my kids have to be responsible, by and large, on their own for what they're going to do. Of course, I'm going to guide them. I want to steer them. I can't live vicariously through my kids. And I wonder how many of us parents are trying to do that. Really, do we let our kids choose and pick and live high school years without the ultimate college in sight? Now, I'm not saying that we should reduce standards, but I'm also referring to leveling of courses and kids that take AP and honor courses for the benefit of getting higher GPAs and college credit, when in fact they're not interested in those courses.
Are you working with the administration? How's that going?
It's amazing. The administration is the reason this is happening to Wellesley's credit. The principal of the high school sees a need and realizes this can be very controversial, but she cares about the kids.
Donna, thank you very much. Good luck.
Thank you.
Donna Testa is a parent in Wellesley, Massachusetts. Not everyone shares Donna Testa's perspective. We turn now to Dr. Robert Weintraub, headmaster at Brookline High School in Brookline, Massachusetts. Dr. Weintraub, welcome.
Good afternoon, Frank.
Are your students stressed?
I think most of them are not stressed enough.
Well, what do you mean by that?
I think there are some students, you know, the most high-powered students who are preparing their resumes for the most highly selected schools in the country, who, by choice, put themselves under stress by taking large numbers of advanced placement courses, honors courses, involve themselves deeply in co-curricular activities, athletics, to build a resume so that they look attractive to the most selective colleges. But they choose to do that. Hundreds of kids go beyond Brookline High and then they come back and visit us. And I've never heard a returning student say that we made them work too hard at Brookline High School. I've never heard that.
Well, we're hearing from admissions counselors. There's one at MIT who told Wellesley parents that she's seeing not only poor kids and poor emotional health, but poor physical health, that they're working too hard, telling the high school, slow down, you're sending these kids to us and they're a wreck.
Well, I think it's interesting for MIT to say that the high school should tell the kids to slow down, because MIT is certainly one of the more, I mean, it's a spectacular school, but MIT is one of those schools that the most high-powered kids try to get into. And in order to get into schools like MIT and Harvard and Yale and Wesley and Middlebury, all those tough schools to get into, you have to have a certain number of AP courses. They judge you on how well you do in the most powerful courses at the school. And so then kids work really hard, and then now you just said that the MIT admissions folks are telling the high schools to get the kids to slow down a little bit. So there's a little bit of a contradiction there.
Do you think, when you talk about some of the high-powered kids, kids you said are putting pressure on themselves, is it the kids or is it their parents?
Oh, I think certainly, you know, it's a combination. You know, Brookline is a highly academic, intellectual community, and there is a tremendous pressure for lots of our kids to go to the top schools in the country. The parents push, the kids push themselves, and the schools, that, you know, Brookline High School, it has a culture of high achievement, and so we contribute to that as well. You know, one of the questions that I raise is, if kids aren't working hard, what else are they doing? And I'm concerned that if we begin to say, slow down, don't take so many high-powered courses, what they engage in then is non-academic work, and I get nervous about that, you know, because of all the, you know, the access to the variety of popular culture, text messaging, TV. You know, I'd rather have them working hard academically. That, you know, that's their job right now. And people have read Friedman's book, The World is Flat. We're moving into a very, very competitive economic world, and I think that the United States, you know, has to push their kids to be skilled and knowledgeable so that they can compete in the knowledge economy. Yeah, there's pressure on a lot of kids, but I'm more concerned about the kids who do not have enough pressure on them, enough stress, and they're not working hard enough. I'm more concerned about those kids.
Well, you talk about watching the kids. Do you have ways of working with students who you think are taking on too much, either their decision or their parents' decision?
You know, we live with the kids. You know, they're here 180 days a year. We monitor their well-being.
Well, monitor, but I mean, is there any way to pull the kid aside and say, hold it, you got to slow down. What are you
thinking? I talk to kids all the time. I mean, in fact, I knew you guys were going to call, and I talked to a bunch of kids yesterday who were here during the summer, and you know, I asked them about this. And the kids who were talking about, the kids who had taken all the AP courses and involved in a lot of co-curricular activities and athletics, they're okay. I mean, they're busy, but they, you know, they buy into that culture. And I personally think that it's not a bad thing.
Dr. Weintraub, thank you.
Thank you.
Robert Weintraub is headmaster of Brookline High School in Brookline, Massachusetts. You're listening to Here and Now. The scavenger hunt has gone high-tech in a relatively new game known as geocaching. It's estimated that some 1 million people are playing, using global positioning systems to search for caches all over the world. The game has become so popular, there are more than 24 geocaching events being held around the world this weekend alone. Margot Kelly is a geocacher, and she's written a book about it. Margot, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us about geocaching. What is it?
Well, it's a relatively new game, and players use a GPS, which is a receiver for getting global positioning satellites, and they figure out exactly where a box of toys has been hidden, often in the woods, and they get there using their GPS. When they arrive, they find a toy that they like and take it, and they put in a toy that they've brought with them to exchange.
Toy, so this is aimed at kids?
It's aimed at kids, but there are plenty of adult players as well.
I can guess. And so where do I find the coordinates? How do I know where to look?
There are a couple of websites, but the biggest website is simply www.geocaching.com.
How did this idea get started?
In May of 2000, the Clinton administration repealed something called select availability. Prior to that time, the GPSs that regular people could have weren't very accurate. But the administration repealed it because they thought that it would be good for developing scientific and transportation technologies. Within a week, somebody had hidden a box of toys in the woods. Four or five people came and found it, and they had the sense almost immediately, therefore, that this is the beginning of a very interesting game.
Who's planting the toys?
Well, they're planted usually by adults, but they're also planted by scouting troops, homeschoolers, geography classes, anybody who thinks that this might be a fun game to participate in.
And you plant the toys, and is, by and large, everybody pretty honest? They take a toy, leave a toy? Or
many people don't take a toy or leave a toy because the adults leave the toys for the kids. And in that case, in America, there's an acronym where people just write TNLN. Took nothing, left nothing.
How expensive are GPS systems?
They're very inexpensive. Right now, a GPS that will work for this game is about $100. The cell phone GPS that you might have won't really work right now for the game, though I imagine in a year or two, probably that technology will be possible for play.
How many people do you think are doing this?
I think about 1 million.
A million people? Now, when I was in Boy Scouts, we used to have to do, you know, triangulation.
Yep.
With and I never got it right. It was hard, but now I'm thinking it may be too easy with a GPS, isn't it?
It's easy to get close, and then it's hard to find the cache once you're there.
And is that because at that point you're operating on pure visual? You have to find the thing,
you
right?
You have to find it, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's always hidden in an environmentally kind way, but it's usually well hidden.
All right. And buried? Do I have to dig?
No, you never have to dig.
Yeah. And is there any kind of regulation?
Yeah. They're hidden in cities and in the woods. And many of the times when they're in the woods, they're in conservation areas, state parks and regional parks and the like. The National Park Service has banned it in the national parks. And the people who run the website have put in the very sensible suggestions that you not put a geocache near a military installation or an airport or an active rail bed. And those recommendations are simply safety factors.
How long have you been at this?
I've been doing it since February 2002.
What do you think people get out of this? Why are people doing it?
Well, that was part of what I was wondering about when I began geocaching. I began in no small part because I was interested in hiking in new and beautiful places. And this was a way that people were introducing me to their beautiful places. But I think really more than that, it's an unprecedented form of community. I think it's a kind of community that combines being in the physical world and being in the virtual world in a way that people are sensing is really important.
But people really aren't together when they're doing the activity, right? I mean, I'm off on my own looking for my cache.
You may or you may not be. There are a couple of things that happen. It's an unusual way for people who already have relationships to consolidate their bonds. I go geocaching with my nieces and nephews. Yeah. Or with colleagues, people who I might not otherwise be likely to go for a hike with. But also there are many events that give people an opportunity to take whatever connections they've built up online back into the physical world.
All right. Margot, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Margot Kelly is the author of the forthcoming book, Local Treasures, Geocaching Across America. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. We'll be right back. I'm Frank Stachow. It's Here and Now. You've heard of the Carters, the Cashes, and the Williams Juniors. One other family is getting into the act. Meet country music duo Hannah McEwen.
If her eyes look away when you're with her, if she sounds far away when you talk, there's a bittersweet taste in every kiss that you never noticed before.
Jamie Hanna and Jonathan McEwen are cousins. Their mothers are twin sisters. After nearly 40 years, their dads are still touring as members of the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. The second generation of Hanna and McEwen are more natty than gritty. Their hair is shorter and, like their suits, well cut. They look groomed for alt-country music stardom. And with the release of their self-titled CD on DreamWorks Records this week, they're on their way. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having us.
I want to talk a little bit about your music now and about kind of where it fits. I hear a little rockabilly, a little alt-country, a few ballads on the CD. How would you describe your music?
That's Hannah McEwen music.
That's right. I think that describes it best.
Or is it alt Hannah McEwen music?
Alt Hannah McEwen. All and alt.
It's all in alt. It's all in alt. It's just a nice collection of influences between Jonathan and I. Some of them the same, some of them different. You got some bluegrass. You've got some folk music. You got some rock elements. You've got some of that rockabilly surf stuff that you're talking about. And then you've got some Beatles/Everly type harmonies, and I think when you just mix it all up in a bowl, you get Hannah McEwen.
Well, you know what's interesting is you hear the influences, but they're discreet. In each song, it seems that each tune has its own sensibility. Are you moving toward a time when you think there's going to be a kind of fusion in the sound? Is that important?
Do you remember country in the 70s? You could hear cross genres. You could hear cross-pollination going on. I think that what we have naturally is just, you know, with all the background that we have, we're looking at maybe being part of a new sound that you can comfortably say it's Nashville, yet it comes from all over the country. We're just proud to be representing the Nashville scene right now.
Well, you talk about that Nashville scene, and your fathers broke through the country music establishment, in a sense, a generation ago with their big hit, Mr. Bojangles. I mean, that set that industry and that part of the industry on its ear. How do you think your music fits into that, into a genre that really is still, to some extent, dominated by good old boys?
I think it fits in from the point that harmony has always been really important in country music. And I think that's really what our common thread is in this on this record, as far as like fusing different influences and elements of music. Our guitar playing and harmonies are definitely the sound that we're going for. And so, you know, from record to record, it's our voices that are going to be distinct.
And of course, writing plays an important part in all of that. Jamie, you've co-written most of the songs on this CD. Well, let's listen to some of this one. Jamie, Tell Me is one of the ones that you wrote with Raul Malo and Alan Miller. Let's hear some of that.
Hey, tell me how I've come to be the biggest fool in history. I fall in time and time again. Help me, darling, tell me when I gave it up to you. Tell me what else could I do. Tell me now. Tell me how.
Tell Me, from Hannah and McEwen. Jamie Hanna and Jonathan McEwen are my guest. Tell us a little bit about performing as well. I've heard a rumor that you do a little bit of a quivering Elvis imitations on stage. Is that true?
Depends on the night. We range anywhere from some Elvis to Willie to Prince to you name it.
Jamie Hanna, as we said, you've written co-written most of the songs on the CD, but you did write one ballad on the new CD, Jonathan, Prayer for You, and it feels a little more personal than the other tracks.
Well, it is very personal. My friend Jesse came to the porch in Ojai, California, and banged out this track he'd been writing in London. He was on the road with Supertramp at the time, his dad's band. He said, I got this idea. I wanted to see what you think, and I kind of said, well, I think we should run with this, man. This is really good. And I felt it, felt near and dear to it from that moment.
So
I'll say a prayer for you in my own little way. I know you might be coming back this way, so I'll say a prayer for you.
Prayer for You from Hannah McEwen's self-titled CD, just released on DreamWorks Records. They're making a name for themselves these days, but you might know their fathers, Jeff Hannah and John McEwen of the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. Have you guys ever played with your fathers?
Yeah, we've done quite a few gigs with them, and Jonathan's played with his dad for years and years, so there's definitely some influence that rubbed off on us from those guys.
What do you think you got from your fathers, musically and personally?
We kind of learned that it was okay to have more than one genre of music as an influence, like those guys. Everything has been, you know, affected them musically all the way from early jug band days to rock music to you name it.
You know, it always sounds good to say that there are so many influences that make up the music, but the industry seems loath to, put you in a, or not have a category for you. What do your audiences make of your switches from one genre? I mean, what does your country audience think of the Prince imitation, for instance?
That's probably one of their favorite things we do. I think the attention span of the audience these days is kind of quick and tight and tidy. They have access to millions of songs at the palm of their hand, so I think it's good to show them you can give them a little more than they bargained for. They feel like they get a deal.
Well, you guys are on your way up. You're playing country music festivals all over the country. You're singing for the troops at the Grand Ole Opry live. There was a live broadcast on Armed Forces Television along with Dolly Parton and a guy named Don Rumsfeld. What did you guys play for?
New country guy named Donnie Rumsfeld.
Yeah,
coming
yeah,
up
and he's got
DreamWorks.
Uh-huh.
What a cool thing to be playing for the troops and then having your bag searched.
Yeah, well, you got to keep the music safe. What did you guys play for the troops?
We played our last single, which was called Something Like a Broken Heart and Ocean, our single that will be coming out here in just a little while. We played those two songs, and they showed footage of the troops listening to our stuff and digging on it, and it really that was probably the coolest part for me personally, that to see people so far away in such a foreign place being able to kind of take a little bit of that with them.
Something Like a Broken Heart from Hannah McEwen's self-titled CD.
It's like a lonely Friday night downtown, where
Jamie Hanna, Jonathan McEwen, thanks so much for talking with us.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Thank you. Anytime.
For more on Hannah McEwen's music and a tour schedule, visit our website at here-now.org.
I could drive 100 miles and never touch that dial till the station fades.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Frank Stachow. Robin Young is back on Monday. Have a good weekend and join us again here and now.
And the more I think it's true, the more I think of you. I don't know why goodbye's so hard to understand. You're never hard to find, 'cause you're always on my mind, no matter where I am. Just like a lonely Friday night downtown, where everyone I know.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Frank Stachow.